Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Many Western entrepreneurs and businesses have foundered trying to set up shop in China. Different expectations, different ways of doing business, different institutions and platforms all come together to remove any pretensions that one can easily transplant a foreign business model into the Chinese market. One of these entrepreneurs was Xavier Naville, who moved to China in 97, where he built Creative Food. Unlike many others, his venture was a success. It's now a key supplier to major restaurant chains across the country, including McDonald's, KFC, and Starbucks. The Lettuce Diaries, how a Frenchman found gold growing vegetables in China, tells Xavier's story growing Creative Foods. Managing a Chinese team as a foreign manager, trying to work with farmers to improve how they can get agriculture, and navigating investor demands. Today, Xavier and I will talk about his time in China, where he talked about starting a business and whether things are different in a more developed, more advanced China. So, Xavier, thank you so much for joining me today. Perhaps let's start at the beginning. What brought you to China in the first place?
Well, it's great to be here, Nicholas. Thank you for inviting me. How did I come to China? I came in 97, age 27. I was a finance officer in a multinational in Paris. And I came to China to become the finance director of the subsidiary. And I thought I was there for just a couple of years, and I ended up spending two decades in China. Two years into it, I started Creative Food and built the company to what it is today. But I essentially came to China as an expatriate.
Right. And what's kind of the period of time we're talking about here? So what are some of the major events that happen while you're in China?
So I came to China in 97 and sold the business in 2008 to a London-listed company that was doing all the fresh food for Marks & Spencer and Tesco, and left the business in 2012. I would say that to answer your question precisely, the major event that affects the food sector in China in that decade from 2000 to 2010 is the melamine scandal in 2008. That represents a major shift in the way Chinese authorities have been looking at the food sector and food safety in general. Up to 2008, there was a major focus on protecting the interests of the peasant farmers in China. After the melamine scandal, the authorities very quickly realized that this fragmentation on the supply side was not sustainable, and they moved to shut down thousands of small dairy operators in China and make it more efficient to produce safe dairy product in China. So the shift in 2008 is from protecting the peasant farmers to protecting the consumers of China.
And not to kind of jump ahead in my questions a bit, but I think you note in your book that the melamine scandal is one where the food safety problem at least appears to become a very real one for China and for Chinese consumers. It's no longer a thing that, say, international businesses care about, but everyone kind of looks, you know, cuts corners, doesn't pay attention. But it became a Chinese problem for a major Chinese company for Chinese consumers. I think that's how you characterize that scandal in your book.
Yeah, I in the book, I talk about the earlier scandals in the trade tensions with Japan when Japanese authorities found chemical residues on frozen spinach coming from China. I also talk about the tensions with EU inspectors on shrimps exported to China. And there was a tendency on the China side to lump all these complaints in either in denial or in they don't understand China phrase that they often use. Melamine was an issue in China affecting Chinese consumers and related to Chinese farmers and middlemen, because the middlemen were the one who added the toxic chemical into the product, not the farmers. So that was a huge awareness that that took place at that time, and that completely shifted the way the Chinese government was thinking about food safety. Today, if you want to do anything in dairy in China, you need to put down $200 million on the table. You cannot do a bootstrapping operation like it was the case before 2008. And that's the way China assures that people who invest in dairy are doing the right thing at scale and that they can be controlled.
So I'd like to take a step back and talk about your experience building Creative Foods. You know, obviously it starts as a spinoff from Asia Foods. And it seems like you're constantly kind of trying to build a company, all the stresses of building a company, trying to find a business model that works, dealing with investors. And then of course you add the difficulty of being a foreigner in China, trying to manage a almost entirely Chinese team and building this new venture. I wonder if you might, it's a big question, I know, but could you kind of share some of what you experienced building this new company?
Well, I think my experience changed over time. I came in very inexperienced. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is I wanted to tell the story of a business success in a way that was very genuine and authentic, in a way that was not linear, because it's not linear. There's ups and downs. So I came in with this idea that I had to be the omniscient leader. I was trying to make all the decisions, and 2 years into it, I nearly drove the company on the brink of bankruptcy. That's where I shifted a bit the way I was operating, by simply acknowledging that I did not know better in China than the Chinese people who were surrounding me, and that despite their inexperience in the field that we were operating in, I had to listen to them much more. And that's, I guess that's the one fundamental shift that happened in my mind. I came with the idea that what worked elsewhere would work in China, and that I would be the evangelist that would bring this this knowledge to China. And I shifted by saying, China is different. It's a different operating environment. What worked elsewhere is not going to work in China. I need to listen and little by little adjust. And that's where I built a different business model, a different culture, and creating a team of people that 15 years later is still running and leading this company.
So maybe let's kind of maybe go through some of those changes bit by bit. Let's start with, let's say, internal. Let's talk about kind of management culture, working, trying to manage local employees, dealing with their expectations, dealing with how they understood their role within a business. What kind of, so for lack of a better word, what kind of pretensions did you come in when you started Creative Foods? And then how did those expectations kind of change, or that understanding change over time as you built the business?
Well, you know, I came in as a young leader. I read a number of business books, and I was trying to talk in inspiring quotes. And when I made presentation to the team, I would do it in English because my Chinese was not good enough. And I would use quotes from whoever, you know, John F. Kennedy and Roosevelt and Churchill. And I quickly realized that just nobody could respond to that. I talk in the book about the sudden realization that my accountant, my simple accountant, associated accountant at the time, was commuting 2 hours in and 2 hours out every day, that she had to supervise her kids' homework for 3 hours every night, and that she was also living with her parents-in-law. And that when I was asking her to be resourceful and self-driven, all these buzzwords, she just did not respond. She could not even understand what I meant. What she wanted is a supportive boss who gave her a safe space where she could do her job. So she needed much more guidance than I could provide to her at the time. So how did I change this? When I let go of most of the foreigners in the business because I could not afford them anymore, I started to learn a bit more. And instead of trying to know it all, I tried to learn it all from the people who were surrounding me. And I led from a vulnerable point of view, asking questions, saying, I don't know that, or I don't know how you do that in China. Why don't you tell me how you would do it? And because my Chinese was not very good, people got into the habit of not rambling and very quickly prepare their conversations with me and quickly make recommendations. And the good point is that I was able to very quickly decide on that. So I guess the important shift in my mind is the realization that I could not lead a Chinese organization like you lead a Western organization. A lot of my employees were very motivated, but they lacked skills, basic management skills. A lot of them had other pressures, the long commute, the pressure, the family pressure, and I had to take that into account. What I realized early on is that many of my employees came from far away. They were not from Shanghai. They were migrants from inside the country. And for them, the company was much more than just a place to work. It was also a place to socialize. They did not have much of a social network outside of the company. And I needed to create that space where they felt safe and secure and where they could express themselves. And if I did that, then I would benefit from their talent and insight. A Chinese friend of mine told me one day, Chinese people can be very shy and reserved, but given the right environment, their creativity will blossom. And he said, you just need to look at the way Chinese behave in a karaoke to understand what it means.
And I want to kind of maybe drill a bit deeper into this conversation about, working styles, management styles, et cetera. Because some of the things you said right now are things that you also see in Western businesses, maybe not to the same degree, but, issues with employees maybe not really engaging with their boss because, because they don't want to engage with the boss, they have the same shyness, long commutes. But also, there are real differences, as you noticed. As you said, it's true that you can't run a Chinese company like you run a Western one. I guess, do you see these as are these just problems of degree that maybe China is just not at the same stage where the West is, or is it maybe different conditions on the ground are leading to these differences in outcome? How do you kind of understand where these differences come from?
You're making a good point in the sense that is it something that is typically Chinese or is it something that is a bit broader that maybe connects to a new generation of managers who want bosses who are involving them more in the decision, who are less directive and who are more authentic or can express themselves in a more vulnerable way. And it's very true. But there is certain characteristics that are specific to China. And there's a couple of them that are crossing my mind. One, this issue that people come from far away and the company is much more than a place to work. It's a place to socialize. And the second is that the mistake that most leaders do is they lead everyone the same way. And I quickly realized in China that many of my employees were very motivated, but they were not highly skilled. And I needed to lead in a different way. I could not simply adopt the American model of giving you a project and telling you to go to F. People barely understood how to go to B. So I had to manage a bit tighter than I would have done in the West. But this idea that employees and managers in the West also want a boss who is more authentic is very true. And you can't escape it because the environment in the West is also increasingly fast changing. And as a leader, you just can't know it all. You have to learn it all, and you need your team to do that.
Of course, not only are you having to kind of develop and train up a Chinese management staff, you have the added complication of having to work with Chinese farmers who are engaging a lot of very traditional farming practices. Could you talk a bit more about how you and your team, some of those struggles in trying to work with actual farmers on the ground in getting them to adopt different farming techniques, different applications of, you know, agricultural technology? What are some of the struggles that you faced with that you dealt with in that space?
Yeah, that's a good point, because I've learned to respect the Chinese farmers tremendously. So just as a context, before I make some comments, is one has to understand that the Chinese farmers have been whiplashed left and right for the past 4 or 5 decades. They've been through, you know, when China opened up, when China was liberated in 1949, they for a very brief moment, they got ownership of their land, which they had never had for centuries, most of them. And then suddenly they moved to a communal farming system for 15 years, and that didn't work. And it's only in the early 80s that they started to operate their own plot of land with this land use right system that Deng Xiaoping implemented in the early 80s. So as a result of that, Chinese farmers don't trust anyone. You can promise them everything. I went to the farms. I promised them that we would replicate California in China, that we would ship to Japan, that everybody would make a lot of money. And they looked at me and they shook their head. I bought high-quality fertilizer and pesticide to make sure that they did not buy anything that was tainted. I gave it to them. And the first thing they did is sell it on the market and pocket the difference and buy the cheap stuff. So were they dishonest? I don't see it this way. I just think that they did not trust anyone. What I saw happening is that over the years, they saw that I was still there, that I was still buying from them, and that I was never the best price, but I always bought from them at a reasonable price. And you know what? For them, that was the most important thing, because they had a steady business. Many of them ended up investing and getting government support to expand their operations. And I built a network of decent-sized farmers across China who knew that they could earn a profit working with a foreign company like me. I don't know if I'm answering your question like this, but I find that they've been, despite their initial prejudice and despite my rollicking stories in the book, they have built a deep relationship with the farmers that I was working with. We were working indirectly with close to 30,000 farmers, so that was a lot of people, and we have helped them consistently improve their income, and I'm proud of that.
And that's a really good segue to my next question. You know, in kind of reading your book, I'm reminded of arguments that, you know, call situations kind of like the China you're dealing with at the time as a, you know, quote unquote low trust society. There's not a lot of trust in institutions, not a lot of trust in contracts and in the law, because they just aren't, you know, they just haven't been developed yet. And so people trust in each other. They trust in their families. They trust in their communities. They trust in people that, in some ways, they can kind of see in front of them. And you kind of, with people we have a long-standing personal relationship with, and that kind of, that's where the trust comes through. And I guess you've already kind of hinted at this, but do you feel like that was matched in your experiences building a business in China? That, as you note, farmers were like, "This guy's coming. He's saying he's talking up a big game, but like everyone else, he'll be gone in 6 months or less." Did you kind of see, I guess, does this idea of China at the time as a low trust society, does that kind of match your experiences actually on the ground?
That's true. And the lack of trust can be explained, as I said, by the historical context. And Chinese socialize in a different way. They refer to their history in a different way. They have an entirely different pantheon of gods and legends and heroes compared to the one we have. The biggest mistake I see people do again and again when they come to China is trying to seek that level of trust that they would seek with another foreign businessman. And usually it's tainted by the fact that we look at personal relationship in China through the lens of our own moral framework. And we're essentially anchored in a Judeo-Christian framework. And in China, I say it's not about trust, it's about aligned interest. So you want to, I don't know if it's low trust. What I know is that most of these people have been through ups and downs, and it's really hard for them to trust anyone. But what I know is that when you can honestly, humbly study the other party and understand what their interests are and build a model where these interests are aligned, where we both have a cost if we breach that relationship, then you will build a relationship that over the years will turn into trust. But the trust is not assumed, as you say.
So we kind of talked about this at the very beginning of the conversation, but I'd like to kind of return to the issues of food safety. This is obviously something that you at Creative Food struggled a lot with, how to kind of match the expectations of consumers, expectations of your suppliers, who had very, very high expectations for food quality, with the actual reality on the ground, all these different small farmers. And I wonder if you might kind of talk a little bit about what you saw at the time. I know you say things are different now, but kind of at the time, what were some of the ways you tried to manage kind of the issues of food safety, food quality?
Yes, yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. And I can also talk about how it's changing. So at the time, and today it's relatively similar, the average size of the farming operation in China is less than 2 acres. So that would be less than 1 hectare. So the... as soon as you're buying large quantities of foods, whether it's produce or meat or anything like that, it's likely coming from hundreds and hundreds of small operations. And it's enough for one farmer to do the wrong thing, and suddenly you've got a food safety scandal at your door. I remember shipping some organic ginger to the UK for our new owner, and we found the best producer, and he had all the right certifications, and we, when the containers arrived in the UK, one of them had some chemical residue in it. So at the time we called the producer, and he had a system to trace back exactly to which plot of land that ginger was connected to. And when we talked to the farmer said, I could not make my order, so I just went and bought a couple of boxes from a nearby grower. And that's at the root of the food safety issues in China, because you've got so many farmers that it's really hard to control that one of them is not going to go sideways. And it doesn't mean they're evil. It doesn't mean that they cannot be trusted, but it means that they do things differently, and they may not understand the implications of what they're doing. For them, it's okay, and for you, it may not be okay. Now, how is this changing? It's changing actually very fast, and today with the new digital platforms, consumers are able to buy directly from farmers. They're bypassing all the middlemen, and that's something I skipped on. Most of the food that is consumed in China changes hands 3 or 4 times before they get to the consumers. And the farmers may not be the main culprit. In the melamine scandal with Sanlu, the people who added toxic chemical, they were middlemen, because they have no vested interest in the quality of the food. They just want to move it fast at the right price. So today, with the digital platforms, what's happening is that consumers are able to buy directly from the farmers, and to establish that relationship that used to exist at the village level, but that has disappeared with the modernization of Chinese agriculture, where farmers are shipping to a random consumers across the country. Today, they get automatic feedback from their consumers. And I tell a story in the book of that young farmer in Sichuan who video streams his growing practice to consumers and get immediate feedback. And he says, it's incredibly rewarding for me to get positive feedback, but also to get negative feedback about what I can improve and what I can change. And that's something uniquely Chinese in the way agriculture is modernizing, because in the US, the agriculture supply chains are extremely consolidated and integrated. So today you've got a sort of digital village that is forming in China with 900 million consumers in the cities buying from 500 million farmers, and all the data is transparently available for everybody to watch.
So I'd like to pivot now to maybe some more forward-looking questions. So first of all, given your experience in kind of building a business in China, obviously many entrepreneurs, many other businesses have tried this and failed. I guess, given your experience, kind of what are some of the general mistakes that entrepreneurs and businesses make as they try to enter the China market?
Yeah, we touched on this a bit, Nicholas, and that's a very important question, because I talked about how many businesses come to China and try to build that relationship of trust. New Zealanders will come to a banquet in Shandong, will have a nice meal with the officials and with their potential partner, and then they will be disappointed that people are not behaving as they expected them to do. And the mistake they make is they're seeking that level of trust that they know in their own society. You can't do that. You have to focus on mutual interest and align the interest. Correlated to that type of mistake is the idea that what worked elsewhere in Malaysia, in Thailand, in another Asian market is going to work in China. And there's this sometimes arrogance, or call it parochial behavior, on the part of Western businesses that come to China and believe that they can replicate what worked elsewhere. China is big, China is complex, and China deserves its own business model. And despite paying lip service to it, I see a lot of people I work with who still have this mindset deeply ingrained that what we've done in the US can work in China. It may work in some ways, and you may not have to overhaul your entire model, but it will have to be adjusted for China, and you need to come with an open mind and a humble mindset about that.
But obviously, I think China is changing. It's getting a lot richer. It's getting a lot more developed. So let's kind of maybe drill down on Chinese consumers and how they're changing, especially when it comes to food. Are they quote unquote modernizing? And again, there's really big quotes around that word modernizing. Are they modernizing in the same way that Western consumers did? Do they care about health the same way? You make an interesting point in your book that I really want to bring out, which is the idea that Chinese consumers and China in general, that they'll follow kind of the traditional Western path, may actually be less likely than China and Chinese consumers becoming global trendsetters. And I wonder if you might get into a bit more detail about your thoughts about where Chinese consumers are going.
Yeah, thank you for asking the question, because it's a very important subject. The Chinese consumer don't trust anyone. They don't trust the brands. They don't trust the advertising. They don't trust the claim from the government certificates. The only people they trust are consumers like them. And research shows that Chinese consumers do an average of 8 checks on any brand they start to buy, compared to 1 or 2 checks for consumers in the West. So they'll find this dairy brand that they find attractive. The first thing they'll do is they'll go online and find a website to make sure that this brand is not completely packaged just for China, but that it has an existing business back in New Zealand, Australia, or Germany. That's a real brand that serves real consumers in other countries. Then they'll go on the company website to download the annual report. They'll and then they'll join chat rooms to talk with other consumers like them and seek their insight about their experience. So they're an incredibly sophisticated consumer, and increasingly so because there's more and more data and information available online. And when they, I would not say that they're modernizing, when they change because they have more income, they have newer needs, they want to be more healthy, like many consumers in the world, they're changing in a uniquely Chinese way. I was surprised myself when I did the reporting for the book, following a couple of moms that I knew from my kids' school, that in average, for example, a Chinese family will eat way more vegetables than an average Western families. We were counting that they were eating 10 to 15 different varieties of vegetable per month, and that it was rotating with the season, so time four. I probably eat 7 or 8 varieties of vegetable, not much more than that. And they want that variety. It's part of their culture. And that's why 80% to 90% of Chinese consumers are still buying the vegetable from the local wet market, because they can find that relationship with the seller and that diversity of product that they can't find in a supermarket. Because for a supermarket, what they want is large volume, less varieties. And this digitization of supply chain that I talked about earlier is actually combining an industrial way of bringing that food to them with the variety that they want, because there you've got 500 million farmers who are now able to sell that vintage black hair pig from the hills of Zhejiang to the consumer in Shanghai. He would never have had a chance to sell to a retailer in China because he would be too small to do that. But he could sell to a consumer directly. So that's one element. They are sophisticated. They're savvy. They want a large variety of choices in their food, and they can now increasingly find it with new digital platforms. And the last thing I would make is that they want to eat more healthy, like many consumers in the world, but they're doing it by resorting to the principles of Chinese medicine. One of the mom I was interviewing in the book was explaining how she drinks red tea during the winter, because it's bringing heat, and she switches to green tea in spring and summer because it's detoxifying and it brings cold to her inner balance. So I was surprised myself to hear that, because I did not realize that the principles of such a traditional belief could pass on to this type of very modern consumer. But it is there. It is there, and it is affecting many of their choices when they purchase brands. So when U.S. businessmen come to me here in San Francisco and tell me, I've got this amazing cereal bar and I want to sell it to China because it's a big market, I'm saying you got to do a bit more homework.
So I think I have one more question. It's another big one. So China's obviously not the same economy that it was when you first built Creative Foods. It's richer, it's more advanced, it's more developed, there's more technology. As you note, I think Chinese consumers are leading the world in some things in a way that I think people outside of China probably haven't glommed onto, things like digital payment, things like e-commerce, that kind of thing. And do you think that someone, Western or Chinese, would be able to build the same business in the way that you did in this more developed environment?
So that's a good question, because I actually specifically went back and called a number of foreign entrepreneurs in China to ask them that exact question a month ago. And the answer is, could a Frenchman who doesn't speak a word of Chinese be able to build a business I built in China today? Probably not, because at the time I was the only one who even thought of doing this. Today you've got a range of professional suppliers who are competing with Creative Food, who are able to do the same quality. What Creative Food did well and what I did well is grow extremely fast, build scale, and be able to offset my maybe higher cost with economies of scale that my competitors could not do. So the answer is, Probably no, not because Chinese don't welcome foreign investors, just because China is becoming more competitive and your competitors are becoming technologically savvy. You've got now, probably we're in the second generation of managers in China who've been trained in professional multinationals for 10, 15, 20 years. And your competitors can hire these people to compete with you to serve people like KFC and McDonald's. So that doesn't mean that you cannot be an entrepreneur in China. You just have to be much more careful about what makes you stand apart. I was interviewing this, I'll take an example of a small business and a bigger business. I was interviewing that entrepreneur who has a chain of New York style pizzas in Shanghai in Beijing. And he was saying, what I did extremely well is recreate that New York atmosphere in the restaurant that none of my Chinese competitor can replicate, because I'm from New York. I know what it means and I know how it feels, and that's why people come to my restaurant. He also did a very good job at building that that very safe culture with all his employees and retaining them over time. The other example from a bigger company is, I don't know if you heard of that app called Evernote, that allows you to take notes online. Evernote's business in China started in 2014. Within 2 years, they had 30 million users. I think today they're at 60 or 70 million users. And they've been extremely successful. And the way they've done that is by completely localizing their app to the needs of the Chinese consumer. So it's a separate subsidiary. It's a separate name even. And it's probably going to get listed before the end of this year in Hong Kong under its own structure. And what they've done is they've reduced some of the features that were successful in the US because it did not appeal to Chinese consumers. They've created new features that work better for Chinese consumers or even for Chinese characters. And they've been very good at doing this. So they came in with a open mind and did not try to replicate their success elsewhere in China. They just adjusted. And when I say you adjust in China, doesn't mean you change your product, but you may change your process. For example, one of the things I've done with some of my clients is help them insert into their process a constant assessment of what the local government agency in their functional area of the business wanted. As you know, in China, every local agency, whether it's the Food and Drug Administration or the Ministry of Industry and Commerce, has a set of objectives, strategic objectives and priorities. And as a business operating in China, you need to understand that so that you can align your interest with their interest and deliver on what they want. If you do that, you'll get a lot of support.
So I think that's a great place to end our interview with Xavier Neville, author of The Lettuce Diaries, How a Frenchman Found Gold Growing Vegetables in China. Xavier, I do have one more question for you, which is, I guess, what's next for you and where can people find the work that you do?
Thank you, Nicholas, for giving me a chance. I've got two activities. I do strategy advisory work for large companies, multinationals in China. It's called Vision Management Consultants. And I've got a separate activity that does coaching work where I help my clients on the execution end of the strategy. And I like to work with a bit smaller business to help the leadership team put together a strategy and then execute it and scale up and do things a bit more intentionally than I did it when I built my own business. So hopefully whatever I learned, I can pass it on to a younger company. So I've got a website called xavier-neville.com and people can book an appointment with me and have a conversation with me. I've got a small assessment that helps us go beyond the polite conversation and quickly assess whether there's something I can do to help them.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The Asian Review Books podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends. If you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Professor Melissa McCauley, author of Distant Shores, Colonial Encounters on China's Maritime Frontier. But before then, thank you so much, Xavier, for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me, Nicholas.